Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 21st, 1999, and in the fireside room this morning,
Wes Howard Brook will start a series on Revelation, and this morning's Bible study will be Reading Revelation Without the Rapture. And this is tape 99-1. Now let's go to Bible study with Wes.
A lot of new faces. I was last here doing summer Bible study in 1996, doing the Gospel of John. And, you know, when I do the Gospel of John, everybody loves the Gospel of John. You know, if people come up and say, oh, it's my favorite text, at least until I'm done with it, it is. And some people aren't quite so sure they like it so much anymore. But I'm not assuming that all of you are here this morning because the book of Revelation is your favorite text of the Bible. No one has come up and told me so far. And so I'd like to start with just a little story of how I got involved with this book. It has something to do with why I start us the way I do. We won't actually get to looking at the book of Revelation itself until Friday this week. So those of you who are leaving before that, sorry to disappoint you. But I think some of our feelings about it and our attitudes, our misconceptions, require us to take a few preliminary steps before we jump right into the book. I've been teaching adult Bible study for about 11 years now. And in my own parish in Seattle, I often do a long fall series, and at the end I have an evaluation form where I invite people to respond to the question of what other parts of the Bible they'd like to have future classes on. And on a scale of 1 to 5, most things get, you know, a 5 or 4 or 3, 5 being the top. But the book of Revelation would get a couple of 5s, and then it would get 1s. But it wouldn't just get 1s, it would get 1s with feeling. You know, it would get 1s with exclamation marks and double and triple underlines and big letters. Some people would write no at the end of the line. There's something going on here. You know, no other part of the Bible, Hebrew scripture or Christian, evokes such powerful reactions as the book of Revelation. And there are obviously a lot of reasons for that, and we won't spend all our time looking at that. But I think the fact that it evokes such powerful emotions, for better or for worse, requires us to look at what's going on that makes so many of us repelled by it, having never looked at it at all, and yet at the same time makes it probably the most quoted book of the New Testament in contemporary culture and in ancient culture. Some of you may know, the more scholarly among you, that in the second century, the book of Revelation was the most quoted of the texts that became the New Testament. It was very popular, and yet in the Eastern Church, it didn't become part of the canon of Scripture until the second millennium, and then really only grudgingly. In our modern world, most of us have heard rumors of Revelation more than actually studied it. And most of the rumors we've heard, frankly, aren't really even part of the book of Revelation. We may associate it with things like the rapture, Antichrist, various end-of-the-world scenarios. Well, neither rapture nor Antichrist are in the book of Revelation at all. The doctrine of the rapture is from 1 Thessalonians. Those of you who don't know what that is, don't worry about it. We'll get there, but it's in 1 Thessalonians 4:17 if you want to know. The Antichrist is only in the first letter of John, not in Revelation at all. What we're often responding to isn't the book of Revelation itself. It's this different text that's woven together by folks who are sometimes referred to incorrectly as fundamentalists, although some are fundamentalists, but that's too broad a term. Sometimes accurately as premillennialists, although not all millennialists are pre, some are post, and we'll get to that in a little bit. They often refer to themselves most as students of prophecy. And so what we often are reacting to is a different text, not a biblical text, but a text woven together by students of prophecy into their own text that they interpret, apparently at face value, but really with a lot of their own baggage, to present one of numerous scenarios of how the world's going to come to an end in your lifetime. And if you're not a believer in Jesus, you're not going to be saved. You won't be raptured. You won't be lifted up on that great and glorious day. So many of us who, you know, like to think of ourselves as intelligent readers of the Bible and intelligent people of faith don't really know much about that, but hear about it and think, well, it sounds weird to me, and if the book of Revelation is about that, I'm not interested. Others who I've encountered have actually tried to pick up the book, and you know, even if you just pick it up at random like I could do right now and read, and the voice that I heard out of heaven speaking again to me and saying, take the open scroll that is in the hand of the angel standing on the sea and the earth, and he gave me the little scroll, and it's bitter in your mouth and sweet, and bitter in your belly and sweet in your mouth, and we go, I don't know what that's talking about. And it sounds like too much work, and it's too confusing, and all these weird battle locusts with their, you know, shields and things, and I don't know what that's about, and it goes back on the shelf. Well, I hope if you'll stick with this process, some of you may be able to and some of you may not for various reasons, either psychically or geographically. The process is going to last 2 weeks. I'd like to suggest now at the beginning that the book of Revelation, I've come to believe, is the book that speaks most to the situation we're in our world today. But not because it speaks of the end of the world. It doesn't. Read fairly, it's not even about the future. It's about the present. Not the present because all generations were awaiting our generation, but because it was about its present and the always present, not about the future someday or the end of the world, but because it speaks to a situation of Christians in cities struggling to figure out how to be faithful to the gospel, surrounded by a culture that is very foreign. And yet we've often, as Jeremiah was talking about in the passage last night, seduced, enticed into collaboration with a foreign reality. So seduced that we don't even realize it's happened. And Revelation is a wake-up call, intended in its powerful language, sometimes violent language, sometimes just simply, you know, strong metaphorical language, to wake us up. So that's the goal, is to help us see it in its own context. And that's why this week we'll look today at some of the barriers that prevent us from seeing openly and some of why and how that works. Tomorrow we'll look at some of the secularized apocalyptic phenomena that are very popular in our time that I believe serve as substitutes for the book of Revelation amongst people for whom the Bible is not their source of wisdom. So tomorrow we'll look at such fun things as alien abductions and near-death experiences and Marian apparitions and shamanism and fun stuff like that, if you think that's fun. I was here, Maggie and my wife and I were here leading the Advent Retreat in 97, and I was sitting in our room reading this book Alien Abduction, UFOs, Alien Abductions, and the Conference at MIT. And Maggie said, I'm a little worried about you as I read these choices. I'm just reading a book. I'm not having an experience here. So we won't have an alien abduction experience as far as I can tell, but I think there's some stuff to be learned about what's going on in our world from that. On Wednesday, we'll look at the roots of the apocalyptic tradition, way back to Zoroastrianism in ancient Persia, but also as it's found in 600 years of biblical tradition up to Revelation. On Thursday, we'll look at the world of the ecclesiae, which is the Greek word that's usually translated church, but I think church carries such baggage for us that we associate many things with it, which should not be associated with the Christian communities in the Roman province of Asia. So I use the word ecclesiae not to be obscure, but hopefully to be fresh, give fresh light. So we'll look at the world out of which Revelation was written. And then Friday, we'll look at the messages to those seven Christian communities and how they might speak to our time. For those of you here next week, we'll continue to look at the plot of the book of Revelation, such as it is, and the cities of Babylon and New Jerusalem. And we'll also look at the role of worship, liturgy in Revelation, which is a very powerful thing and not really anywhere else in the New Testament. So that's the roadmap. To get us started, I'd like to get you turning to each other a little bit. As I suggested, many of us come with baggage. We lump under this broad category of fundamentalism rumors we've heard of various ways the world's going to come to an end in a 7-year, you know, scenario, or the Antichrist is going to rule in a certain way, or, you know, various things. My goal is not to have us play through all those scenarios, but to ask two questions. What human needs, either of this moment or of just humanity in general, are those kinds of scenarios and that kind of reading of Revelation appealing to? You know, what is it in us, you know, in us as humans, or in particular people in particular places, is that responding to? And I want to note, before you start talking to each other, it's a peculiarly American phenomenon. You know? My co-author of the book that I have coming out in September, the book's called Unveiling Empire, Reading Revelation Then and Now. And my co-author, Anthony Gwither, lives in Brisbane, Australia. And as we were working up who was going to write which parts of the book, he said, "You handle all that stuff." Because it's not a phenomenon in Australia much. There really isn't such a thing as premillennialism, and the whole end of the world thing is not, it doesn't really exist in Australia or in Europe. It's an American thing. So there's something about our culture that's generated this phenomenon, so I just invite you to consider that too. So what is it about our situation as Americans and as humans more broadly that this is responding to? And second question is, why does it work? You know, premillennialists are not just, you know, country hicks, uneducated folks. We can't write them off as just being stupid or gullible. You know, various kinds of studies and surveys have shown that premillennialism is really the dominant religion of America. It's not a southern phenomenon. It's not a rural phenomenon. It's not a lower class phenomenon. It exists, you know, at every level of our society, among every race, and every economic and social group. And premillennialists outnumber every other denomination in this country. So we're not talking about some obscure cult. There are more premillennialists than there are Lutherans. I happen to be Roman Catholic. There are more premillennialists than there are Roman Catholics. Why is this the dominant religion of America? You know, why do ordinary, intelligent people believe that the world is going to come to an end at some given moment in the near future, and if they believe in Jesus, they'll be saved? Why does it work? So I'd like to invite you to take just a few minutes, and when you're either bored, or you figured it out, or you're stuck, you can look up this way, and I'll have some idea that we'll gather our thoughts together. But I'd like to invite you to turn to no more than three people together, and just try and puzzle over this together, and then we'll gather our thoughts.
Church in Seattle, and I asked people to talk, and they were silent. And someone came up to me and said, "Well, you know, Norwegian Lutherans don't really like to talk much." I don't know how many you want to claim that one, but anyway. So, what did you come up with? And let's if we can keep these questions separate as much as possible, that'd be great. What needs did you decide, or are you cogitating over, that this whole phenomenon at the end of the world and such is responding to? Anybody? We don't like need for control.
In the midst of chaos.
Okay, need for control in the midst of chaos. Now.
Chaos being YK2, globalization, global economy, diversity.
We'll call it Y2K, but that's all right.
Okay.
Y2K, which others did you name?
Diversity, global economy.
Okay. Do you perceive those, or some people perceive that as contributing to chaos rather than order? Okay.
Ecological disaster.
Under the same category.
Yeah, in that list.
Okay. So we could multiply examples ad nauseum of signs around us that appear that the world isn't the way it's supposed to be, and it makes us feel anxious. And we'd like to be in control. We'd like to feel like somebody's in control, but there is some control element that it isn't just completely chaotic. Okay? Other factors?
Yeah. I think we have an acculturated need to see ourselves as part of a manifest destiny. Always moving to something with a greater purpose. Cataclysmic.
Okay. So as Americans in particular, this powerful image, which has been with us for a long time, of manifest destiny, that we're part of some overriding purpose that compels us forward, first across the continent in a physical colonial way, but then forward through history. Tomorrow will be better than today. It's really a very American kind of phenomenon, that we have the need to see that unfold before us.
I see that as the pull part, and then the push might be that a lot of us came from a place where it was considered the end of the world when we left as immigrants. We were kicked out, or we left because we'd been bombed out. So I don't know, that's...
Okay.
So we're moving on to a better world, and that may be part of our myth culture.
So the immigration experiences that led us out of something dark and unhappy, unjust, and oppressive into something better, and yet sometimes it's not always the promised land that it appears to be for some immigrants, and so there's a need for something else. Yeah, others, just another hand. Yeah.
I would think the need there is, it's a response to the perceived teaching of the New Testament.
Okay, say some more about that, because there's a certain, you're onto something, I think there's a certain circularity to that process, but say some more.
Sure, I know it's circular, but I'm making this intensely personal here, because I was taught this.
Okay.
I was not responding to my culture, necessarily. I was not responding to immigration. I was not responding to the Y2K problem, because this teaching developed in my life, in my home congregation, at a relatively early age.
Okay. So for many people, it's part of their tradition. It's as simple as that. They believe it because it's what they were taught. It's not a 1990s phenomenon. In fact, as I'm sure you know, can I ask what tradition you were raised in? You were taught Lutheran. Really?
Sure.
This is Lutheran. Because I usually associate...
Well, what I'm getting at here is the whole idea that indeed Christ will return someday, and indeed the world as we know it will come to an end at his return.
Okay.
Now, that's the teaching I'm getting at.
Now, in the broad sense, that's pretty mainstream Christian teaching in general. Most people aren't expecting it to happen tomorrow.
No.
And aren't reading the signs of the times as a blueprint scenario for measuring the day and the hour, which is more of the specifics of what I'm aiming at here. Yeah, as a kind of eschatological someday at the conclusion of all, it's fairly mainline doctrine. But there's obviously something more urgent to premillennialism that is popular these days.
That's what we were kind of talking about, was there, since biblical times, it's been talked about, the end times and Jesus coming again or whatever, but all the baggage that has been put on that, that's what you're getting at. Because the core of what he was just saying is in mainline Christianity and just across the board. So it's not like this is a separate group of people who believe this. It's all the other extra baggage that maybe the mainline thought doesn't buy into, that baggage. There's just and maybe that's where you're talking about American interpretation. Maybe that's where it becomes unique. Because the mainstream of just the idea of Christ coming again was something Paul talked about, so.
Yeah. Sure, and that's right. And in the same way that we as people, brought up in a scientific world, know that someday, too, the sun will burn out, but it doesn't affect our daily life much. In a similar way, someday Jesus will come back, but in the meantime, I'm going to the store. I'm planning for my kid's future, and we're going ahead and living life. So I'd like to just keep separate a little bit the kind of long-term sense of that from the sense of any moment now, and it's expected and it's going to happen. Because if you read, how many of you have ever read Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth? Not very many. How many of you have never heard of Hal Lindsey? Don't be embarrassed. A few. Now, I find that a powerful thing in itself. It shows there is a great split here, not among everybody, and probably very few of you actually read the book. For those not familiar, Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth was the best-selling book of the 1970s and the 1980s. Has sold to date over 40 million copies. Let that sink in for a second. 40 million copies. And some of us have never heard of it. It was, I assure you, at your grocery store's checkout stand for years, but you probably don't buy books off the grocery store checkout stand and don't even look at them much. They're next to the National Enquirer and that kind of thing. It just slipped by your consciousness. But it was, you know, the founding book for the latest generation of this tradition, a tradition which, though, goes back to at least the mid-19th century and had its first wave of popularity in light of the Civil War, but goes back earlier than that.
Having read it, though, as you with your MIT book, doesn't mean we agreed with it.
Absolutely. But just to say, one reason I'm dealing with this as a starting point is to say that a book that 40 million people have bought, and most of whom have bought at least some high percentage have read, and some of whom have believed, is a powerful phenomenon that we need to be paying some attention to, because it purports to be an interpretation of, at least in part, the Book of Revelation. And I'd like to suggest at the outset, it's not really an interpretation of the Book of Revelation at all. It's an interpretation of this meta-text, if you will, this text made up of a little bit of Thessalonians, a little bit of Ezekiel, a little bit of Daniel, and half a verse from here and, you know, one chapter from there, that's been woven into the text for premillennialism. No particular biblical text, and in fact, as I suggest, sometimes half a verse, you know, carved out of here, you know, woven into one verse there. So there's a certain, in fact, little bit of an intellectual dishonesty about it, although I don't think they see it as intellectually dishonest. They see it as the, operating under the principle of biblical prophecies are meant to be literally fulfilled. If there is not evidence that they've been literally fulfilled, then they will be literally fulfilled. Let's watch for it and see when it's going to happen. Okay? So if there's a description, you know, in Ezekiel of Gog and Magog, for example, then what might that mean? Now, I want to underscore, we won't focus on fundamentalism too much, but it's not about taking the Bible literally. Not at all. You know, if you read any of the end of the world scenarios, they go through all kinds of metaphorical leaps and things to put it together. I do a little scenario with the woman I was teaching some of this stuff with, where she plays a Hal Lindsey disciple and I play me trying to read Revelation 18, which starts off talking about Babylon. And she says, well, now, Babylon is the Soviet Union and blah, blah, blah. I said, no, wait a minute. I thought Babylon was an ancient city and, you know, and Middle East and such, and Mesopotamia. And she said, no, Babylon, it's a code word for this. Well, okay, then you're not taking the Bible literally. Oh, yes, we are taking it literally, but it means this. So, it's not what we think at all of literalism, of it means exactly what it says. It's literal, though, in the sense that it expects it to be literally fulfilled, events to actually happen in the physical world at some particular point in time. Now, I want to suggest at the outset that my reading of Revelation, and I think the one that it was intended, how it was intended to be interpreted, didn't expect that at all. The other piece, and we'll get to this on Wednesday in detail, the other piece of our struggle with the Book of Revelation is that most of us are not, speaking kind of bluntly but honestly, are just not that literate when it comes to Hebrew Scripture. There's almost nothing in the Book of Revelation that isn't an echo of Hebrew Scripture. There's not almost not a single image in the entire book that hasn't been heard before if you're familiar with the Hebrew Bible. Most of us don't know it that well, so we hear those images as if John of Patmos was naming them for the first time. That's why on Wednesday we'll look at the struggle of in Daniel's time and going back to the post-exilic struggle a little bit, where the third Isaiah texts are in conflict with the Ezra Nehemiah text. You know, not texts that we tend to read that much. And I don't want to burden us with a lot of historical detail, but it'll just be enough to show us that when we read it in its context, it's about a way of seeing the world, interpreting the world, not about a blueprint for the future. But just completing this piece, people named some of the struggles. Any other things that people want to name as factors that make this appealing? Yeah?
I think the problem of evil is a big one, that we're going to get rid of evil in a more radical way. We, in a confused world, we sort of tolerate it or work around it, and this cleans it off.
Okay. Evil, one of the two key themes, I'd suggest. Yeah. What's the struggle with evil? At one level, it's a question that theologians refer to as theodicy. You know, how can there be a just God in an unjust world? You know, where is God's justice in the face of the Holocaust and other terrible events like that? At another level, it's the day-to-day question, how do I live in the midst of it? You know, what am I to do in the midst of evil? What is evil? What behavior is proper and what isn't? How, you know, how do I interact with it? Do I fight against it or do I just let it be?
Anything else?
Yeah. What about good old Catholic guilt that we haven't lived the life we should have lived before Jesus Christ comes back?
Guilt. Now, I was working with this in the first group. Guilt is interesting here. Someone else raised this in terms of human worth or the worth of your life. I think there's some guilt is kind of the psychological response to the question of, you know, is my life worthy or have I lived my life properly? This, I'd suggest, is connected with the issue of time. Now, it might not be obvious how guilt is connected with time, so let me take a couple steps deeper in that, and we can see how, really, I think that this whole phenomenon is responding to the classical questions of evil and time. You know, the struggle of humans as finite creatures in time has a couple of components. One of the central ones, going all the way back to Abraham and such of the Bible, is, will anybody remember me? Is my life worth anything? How do I evaluate this journey I've been on? Is it just, as the author of Ecclesiastes, you know, anticipating existentialism, writes, you know, the sun goes up, the sun goes down, so what? You know, we go round and round and round, and nobody remembers anything, and nothing I do makes any difference, and why bother? You know, how'd that book get in the Bible anyway? But that's really the struggle there in that book. You know, ostensibly in the voice of Solomon, who you'd think would be remembered more than anybody, but that's the part of the point of, if even Solomon could be forgotten, what about every ordinary person? So part of this question, I think, of guilt is, you know, judgment, obviously, but it comes out of our having projected the issue of time onto afterlife. You know, the question of my worth, my meaningfulness, will be judged by God after I die. So even if nobody remembers me, God will remember me. And even if I'd like God to forget me, God will remember me. You know, fear of hell and that kind of thing. Okay? Now that operates at the individual level. It also operates at the collective level. First at the collective level of your family. You know, that's the biblical story of, you know, Abraham, you'll be remembered as the father of children and grandchildren, etc. So you'll be remembered and your children and that. But there's also the collective story of who are we as a people? How will we be remembered? Are we important to history? Or are we just, you know, passing sandcastle builders and it all turns back to dust? The struggle over time is really one of the deep issues of human existence. And it's at the center of this phenomenon, which will lead us to the other side here, I hope, which is to ask the question of, why is it successful? Why do ordinary, intelligent, rational people believe that if they believe in Jesus, you know, they'll be lifted up in the rapture, or that there'll be this seven-year scenario of the Antichrist and such, and all the various tribulation stories that have been evolved. You know, why does it appeal? Why does it work? Why is anybody convinced of this in response to these human needs?
The reward?
Reward?
The reward.
What's the, and the reward is?
Well, I look at it from a historical perspective, the sort of a manifest destiny thing. If you work hard, you'll succeed. If you live right, you'll be rewarded.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that gives you two sides of us and they.
Okay. But the reward here is responding to this question of justice
right. As
well. You know, there is justice in the sense of, I believe, it's very simple justice. If I believe in Jesus, I'll be okay. Very simple, reduced to its absolute, you know, bottom line factor. Okay. None of that business about Matthew 25 and, you know, all those hidden times Jesus was in your midst and you didn't notice. You know, that's a little more complicated.
But in Revelation, isn't it also being faithful? Not just believing in Jesus, but when the martyrdom comes to you, you don't give in.
Okay, we'll get to Revelation in a while. You're right. And there's some of that in the premillennialist stuff. There's certainly a willingness to say, as was held up in the Columbine stuff among some of those kids recently, of, yes, I was willing to say, I believe in Jesus, and you know, rather than deny it. So there is that, a faithfulness as well. Yeah.
I wonder if it has something to do with the, you're talking about that book, that 40 million people are, I mean, why did it work? Because that's what other people are reading and thinking. I don't know how to...
There's something to that, yeah, that once you're in that subculture, then it's part of community, it's part of belonging, and I want to put that up there. People didn't name it otherwise, so I do want to name that. It's an important thing that we sometimes forget, that some of the great appeal of the whole premillennialist stuff is not the people in their heads or even in their guts or hearts or wherever you think of our centers being, make a decision about this. It's that those are the people who, when they were lonely, welcomed them in and cared about them. And when they were single, parents took care of their kids so they could come to Bible study, or 100 other ways in which some of the large suburban fundamentalist kind of churches really reach out and support people. It's not just Sunday morning religion. You know, it's 24 hours, seven days a week if you need it. So there is a powerful sense of community. And if you're part of the community and that's where you feel connected, then you'll say or you will believe whatever is required to be believed to remain part of that group.
Is it something in us that wants answers to a definiteness rather than ambiguity?
Okay. So there is provided this clarity in the face of ambiguity and chaos. Yeah. Absolute bottom lines.
Getting back to that time concept, the good African theology. My name is in the book. I'm going to be remembered. I'm amongst the living dead.
Okay. And, so we will be remembered. We respond to the question of time with, yes, God remembers me. My name's in the book, which is an image from Revelation.
The fact that God wins, the fact that God's in charge, it works because in all the insecurity and everything else, we don't accomplish it. God does.
Yeah, good. You know, that, and I'd like to use that as a, we got to go on in this for the sake of time. I think I'll try and pull some of this together. I want to get a couple other things out for your consideration. But this business about God wins, it's in God's hands. I don't remember if it was here in one of the prayers or the songs or somewhere I've been in the last week. But we often hear this sense of, you know, we are your hands and feet, oh God. You know, that's a wonderful mainline liberal theological statement, which these folks would say, what a bunch of hogwash that is. You know, there's a real theological divide over that. And some of it has to do with, as someone said in the first group this morning, the question of taking responsibility or not. You know, one of the appealing things about this whole scenario is, if God's in charge, I don't have anything I have to do. You know, so all the social ills and personal struggles, nothing I can do about it. It's part of the blueprint. God's in charge. God's going to win. All I have to do is trust.
Now, I was going to say just the opposite. I see this as a way of a behavioral control.
But in a very simplified, pared-down way. You know, the premillennialists will not get involved in social movements and campaigns. In fact, they see that as interfering with God's plan. You know, they were, great at the beginning of the 20th century, greatly resistant to the whole social gospel movement as, you know, diabolical. You know, it's part of the human belief and a human arrogance that we can fix things. We can't fix things, they say. Only God can fix things. In fact, they don't even need to be fixed because it's all part of God's plan anyway. It's not broken. You know, the extreme version of that is expressed in the book Blessed Assurance, if people know that book. The subtitle is At Home with the Bomb in Amarillo, Texas. And a journalist went to visit Amarillo, was wondering how good Christian people could be working at the Pantex plant, which is the final assembly plant for all nuclear weapons in this country, and be good, loving Christian people and go to work every day building nuclear weapons. And what they found was that most of these people were of the premillennialist traditions, and they saw that the continuing decline of society was part of God's plan, that nuclear war was inevitable. Trying to stop it was a diabolical illusion, and that as long as they believed in Jesus, they'd be raptured. Hallelujah. You know? Well, that might give the chills to some of us, but I hope you can at least imagine how comforting that would be if you believed it at a certain level. Too bad there has to be nuclear war, but if God's in charge and we get saved, well, it's the way it goes. And everybody can be saved. All they do is believe in Jesus. It's not an us versus them thing. That's, of course, why many of these folks are such powerful evangelists. Out of love. You know, out of a real desire to save people, to include people within the fold, so they can be part of the rapture, too. It's not a cult mentality of the handful of us will hunker down against the enemy and you know, nobody can invade our small space. It's very evangelical.
I'm getting a little confused. Can you define premillennialism as you see it?
Nice segue to my hand. Now, I made 50 of these, and I realized it wasn't enough because I gave out some this morning. If you're part of a couple, I'd invite you to share. And you're welcome to take one. I'm sure we can make more. Leave me the last one, maybe, and maybe we can make more copies. I'll try and anticipate that for the rest of the week. But there are some definitions on here. I won't invite you to study that now. Obviously, you can look at that at whatever level you want in your spare time. But there are some terms on there defined: premillennialism, postmillennialism, etc. I'd like to highlight just one distinction for now so that we at least are in common ground. The term fundamentalism, which is what we often use as this broad category, is too broad a term. Not all fundamentalists are millennialists at all. Some, not all millennialists are premillennialists. For those not familiar with the term, premillennialism in its shortest sense is the belief that the rapture will come before the 1,000-year reign of Jesus. Okay? That's why it's pre. Postmillennialism is that the 1,000-year reign of Jesus will come and then the rapture will follow. Okay? Most millennialists in this country are premillennialists. And then there are all kinds of subdivisions, as you can imagine, just like in any other Christian tradition where, you know, people argue about details and form subgroups. But the large picture is people expecting that there'll be this literal end and looking for it, reading the signs of the times, including reading the book of Revelation in this peculiar way. Okay. One thing is just a movement away from some of this toward what I hope to get to is one word on there, and I'll say one more thing and get back to it, and that's the word apocalyptic. But before I get to that, I realize that one more thing on tying this piece together. That's the American angle on this, because I said that at the beginning. One of our particular American things that somebody named about Manifest Destiny, as well as the immigration experience, but I think Manifest Destiny is part of it, is this need to fix things. You know, this belief in can-do. This short-term solutions will solve things. The latest example of that was our agony over Kosovo, where, you know, you saw an awful lot of people who are not in favor of war saying, well, we had to do something, didn't we? With a great deal of anxiety. I was watching those events, watching the kind of psychological effect of it as well as the political, to see in the people's tone and in their words how much anxiety was being expressed over, we got to do something. We can't just stand by and do nothing. Well, we stand by and do nothing in Colombia. We stand by and do nothing in Cambodia and in Thailand and in Africa and all kinds of other places. What was it about Kosovo that suddenly we couldn't stand by and do nothing? Well, it was brought to our attention. And once a problem is brought to Americans' attention, they get very anxious if they don't know how to fix it. I'm not saying you and you, but just generally as a people. You know, Europeans and others have a long picture. You know, they have a long history and don't expect things to be fixed that easily. Now, this tradition responds to that a different way by saying, trying to fix it's an illusion. God's in charge. We're not God's hands and feet. We weren't there at the creation, after all. God managed to do that without our help. It's worth pausing to remember that. So God can do things without us. God does not need us to get God's work done. Sometimes we forget. These folks also, as I was suggesting, are willing, because of their solution, to look the chaos and the trouble of the world in the eye and not flinch. And in my experience working with this material, I'm really amazed at how often I listen to sermons. Maya's last night was not one of those, but I listen to how often you know, the struggles of the world, even the struggles of what happened today when terrible events happen, are just not even touched on. It's as if we expect our congregations to live in this little vacuum on Sunday morning that's apart from, you know, are my kids safe on the way to school? You know, will my corporation cut back and I'll lose my job? What about the high price of housing in big cities and pollution and, you know, global warming and all these things? As if our faith had nothing to do with any of those things. Well, this tradition is willing to look at all those issues, and their solution is, it doesn't matter. It's all coming to an end. Well, I think Revelation is inviting us to look at those things with a different outcome, but not to either say, we can fix it, let's just organize and work harder, kind of the liberal, general liberal solution, or what has become the de facto solution, let's just not talk about it. Let's just not deal with it. If we deal with it in our churches, it'll be polarizing, people have different points of view, people stop coming, they'll stop giving a collection, And we have buildings to maintain and institutions to support, and we can't afford to risk alienation. And, you know, we don't want to be Jeremiah. We don't want to be the people who are hissed at and thrown down the well. You know, we want to be popular, and we want to keep the thing going, and want to take people where they're at and just move things one step at a time, and just don't deal with it. Revelation is a great wake-up call to deal with it, you know, to look at it, but not because we can fix it, and not because we just sit back and say, okay, God, you take care of it. There's some combination of things involved there. A definite work on our behalf, but not to solve the problem, not to see it even as a problem to be solved, but as a choice in our God-given freedom to be made moment to moment in our individual lives, in our collective lives. We'll have to see how that unfolds further. Apocalyptic. What do you associate with that term? Don't think about it hard. Just respond. You know, what do you associate with the term of apocalypse or apocalyptic?
Fire.
End times.
End
of the world.
Four horsemen.
Marlon Brando.
Oh, Apocalypse Now. Huh? Okay, great. Took a step there.
Future.
Sea goddess. Calypso.
Oh, it takes a scholar to get that one, huh? All right, thank you, Marvin. But you're right, of course. That's good. People hear that?
No.
I just want you to say it again.
Calypso, the Greek deity, the veiled goddess.
Okay. So a literary person or admits gets it here. Seeing past the secular angles on this, most of us through the secular media in our everyday life see this having to do with end of the world, catastrophes, violence, fire. You know, the word is used as an adjective, an intensifier in ordinary life to describe powerful things. Whether it's religious and end of the world things like the premillennialists, or just ordinary events, you know, a cataclysmic earthquake is, you know, apocalyptic. Hell, I see football games described as apocalyptic. But as Marvin correctly points out, the root has to do with the veil, and the veil being lifted. Did people hear it in Matthew's gospel last night? I turned to my wife Maggie and said, hear that apocalyptic. You know, she's used to it, you know. But there it was, when, you know, there's nothing that is hidden that will not be revealed. And the verb there is the verb form of apocalyptic. In Greek. And so there's two components of this that I'd like to focus on, as we will throughout this week and for those of you here next week. One is there's a mystical visionary component here. And the other is there's a social and political component. And it's really important that we see those both together. Many modern scholars of the Book of Revelation, maybe it's because of the scholarly paradigm or their own faith stance, I'm not sure, but tend to describe John of Patmos, the seer in Revelation's text, as a quote-unquote literary device. They either doubt or don't even raise the issue of whether he actually had any kind of experience, but see the whole phenomenon of writing in terms of, I looked up into the sky and I saw, it's just a way of writing. Not grounded in his personal experience at all, not having to do with God and encountering him and his humanity, but just as someone sitting back and writing a story. Okay, I don't think so, personally. There's no way to prove it, but just to let you know my starting point. Because there's a powerful tradition, both biblically, extra-biblically, and just humanly, of people encountering the sacred, the divine, not because they engaged in the right prayer techniques, but because they were just grabbed. Many of you may well have had an experience like that. I have myself, so that's what got me into this. Not for the end of the world, you can rest. but just a sense of being apprehended by God. You know, it's nothing more obscure than the entire mystical tradition of a couple thousand years of Christianity. You know, some sense of being in the presence of the sacred that we didn't earn in his grace and gift. I think John had that kind of experience, maybe once, maybe a lot of times, who knows, but that he was grounded in that experience. That experience was an unveiling. It taught him that what appears to be reality is not ultimate reality, depending upon which way your metaphor goes. There's more to life than meets the eye, if you have eyes to see. You can't get there by reason, you can't get there by your senses. You can't think harder and get that. It comes as a divine gift. But there's another piece that's the social and political part. And that's the part in which all of us perceive reality as, in part, as taught to us by a social system. It's what in social science, you know, they call the social construction of reality. There's a whole field called the sociology of knowledge that deals with how we are taught to perceive reality in accordance with a given dominant culture. So we only see certain things. If we see things other ways, there are enough social sanctions, powerful ones or subtle ones, to, you know, say, you're crazy, you know, is a powerful social sanction. Before we had mental illness as a kind of pathology, there was this sense of people who thought strange thoughts were deemed outside the bounds of the community in some way. So now, you know, unorthodox opinions leads people to, you know, distance themselves from them. You know, when I left being a lawyer, and I trust lawyer, I went to study theology and ministry at Seattle University almost 15 years ago now. A lawyer friend of mine ran into another lawyer who said, "Did you hear about Wes? He flipped out." And my friend said, "I don't know what you're talking about. He's over at Seattle U studying theology." He said, "See, I told you." So there is a sense in our culture and in many cultures, you do unorthodox things and people brand you as not having a full deck. You know, and so you tend to see things as you're taught to see things. There's also, in addition to that broad and universal phenomenon, in our culture and in many powerful cultures, some cultures are more powerful than others in doing this, an imposed upon us mechanism for enforcing this on a daily basis. As we'll see on Thursday, in the Roman Empire, it had to do with the machinery of the imperial cult, rituals in the street and temples and coins and all the imagery of divine Caesar that led people to believe that the Roman Empire was a God-given reality, and to challenge the Roman Empire was to challenge the gods. Now, in our culture, it's largely marketing and advertising. Coke adds life. One that really struck me was, you know, music TV, MTV's slogan, "MTV provides reason to live." There's a religious statement, huh? You know, some of those are subtle, some of those are obvious, but we're bombarded with it. A study recently showed that ordinary Americans are perceive 3,000 commercials a day of one kind or another. You don't notice most of them. They're just there. They're on, not in Holden, of course, but they're on billboards, they're on the radio, they're everywhere, magazines. You know, it's just constant bombardment, creating a reality that if you challenge it, there's something wrong with you. For my kid, it's Pokemon cards. It could be anything, though. The result of this is we see life through a veil. We see life not as it is, but as it's imposed upon us. And apocalyptic literature in general, the book of Revelation in particular, calls us to lift the veil, to pull the gauze away from our eyes and see life as it really is. And of course, that's what the prophets did in a certain way in their own experience. That was Jeremiah's experience that we heard about last night. When you see life as it really is, you see what is being promoted as beautiful and wonderful as really violence and destruction. It doesn't make you popular that often. Okay, so there'll be this two-part challenge to apocalypse. The mystical visionary, the question of our experience of the divine, and the question of our experience of a world being imposed upon us. Okay, that's what Revelation is trying to deal with. Anticipation of tomorrow, and then we'll stop. You know, so if you have any questions, we can listen to that. For many people, as we know, the response not only to premillennialism and that kind of thing, but to our churches in general is to say, the Bible, I don't know, the Bible's a bunch of old superstitions, you know, talking snakes and all this nonsense, you know, forget it. As we know, the Bible is not the mainstream document it was in Shakespeare's time, or even in Blake's time, or earlier times where any educated person knew the Bible. The Bible is the primary source from which people discern, how are we supposed to live? Who is God? What are we supposed to do? In our culture in particular, although not uniquely, it's even more true in Europe, the Bible is hardly a part of the conversation. It's part of the inheritance. You know, you see it in the museums, in art, and you hear it in music and such, but it's not part of daily life. So as a result, many people, in trying to find something apocalyptic, something that gives them some message from beyond the veil that helps them live their life, have turned to other phenomena. And I believe, at least, that's what holds together the disparate things of alien abductions and near-death experiences and Marian apparitions and shamanism and all these phenomena that have sold millions of copies of books and have their whole little industries built up around them as ways of inviting people to believe there's more to life than meets the eye. But for people from the Judeo-Christian tradition, it is no longer a source of wisdom. It's a certain irony to me that among many people, you know, anybody's religion except the one they were raised in is a possible source of wisdom. Whether it's indigenous people of this country, or Eastern religion, or quote-unquote paganism, not to denigrate any of those traditions at all. You know, I think there is a lot of wisdom there that we can learn from. But it's as if Judeo-Christianity was the only thing that was fake and all the rest of it was real. If we don't take seriously the degree to which people feel that way out there, we're just going to continue to preach to the choir, and we're going to just continue to lose people to either premillennialism on the one hand or New Ageism or something else on the other hand. But regardless of whether people turn to end-of-the-world scenarios or the New Age, they're responding, all those things are responding, I believe, to these same eternal human phenomena that are intensified in our day. And I hope before we're done, you'll agree with me that Revelation has some powerful wisdom to speak to this. And if we can allow ourselves to look at its roots and how it speaks, we can recover that for our congregations and for ourselves. So I'll stop, and if you have any questions, feel free, and I'm happy to stay during coffee break and meet you up there. But if anybody has anything they want to ask before we stop, please feel free.
At the very beginning, were you suggesting, because I missed a few minutes, that the needs that you're talking about are more apparent, evident, etc., amongst people today than they were in previous generation?
There's a both and to that. People have been reading the book of Revelation in particular as expressing an end of the world scenario at some level since the second century. The Montanists were the first in the second century. And so there's been some of that all along. People have looked out at the world and say the world is worse now than it's ever been, and people have somehow always thought that. We could argue about whether, in fact, the world is objectively worse now and more dangerous. I'd suggest it is just because our technology is more powerful and we are reaching the finite limits of capacity for the planet in certain ways. You may argue with that. I'm happy to engage that question with you outside our time here. But I think at least there's the perception that that's the case. Whether it's objectively true or not, you could argue. But I think there's a perception that environmental issues, for example, are at a stage of risk that they never were before. Humans were not affecting global climate, you know, in the past. People could have powerful wars, but they couldn't have wars that could threaten to destroy all life on the planet. You know? So there are certain objective factors, like nuclear weapons and other things, that do make this a more dangerous time than ever before. But at the same time, I think there are also just eternal human needs that are independent of time and place that this is responding. That's what makes Revelation such a powerful book, is it does speak to people throughout human history, at least since the time of its writing. Any others? Okay. Just a note for the week. Tomorrow, as I say, we'll look at this phenomena of secular apocalyptic. Wednesday, if you can't be here tomorrow, or if you're planning to be here Wednesday, either way, I invite you to bring a Bible, especially a Bible that has the Apocrypha in it, because we'll be looking at the book of Daniel, which ought to be in all your Bibles, but we'll also look at 1 Maccabees, which is in the Apocrypha and not always in all Bibles. So if on Wednesday you could bring a Bible that has Maccabees in it, that'd be great. Okay? Thanks.